More Idaho Matters right now from the studios of Boise State Public Radio News. I'm Gemma Gaudet. Author Beth Piatote grew up on a farm in Idaho. She teaches English at Berkeley. She studies the Nez Perce language, and she chairs the graduate group in Indigenous Language Revitalization at UC. Oh, and in her spare time, she also writes short stories and poetry, and she draws heavily on her Native American background. She weaves her culture with themes of love and loss, as well as grief and childhood and longing, into her new book, The Beadworker Stories. Now, the book has won critical acclaim. It was featured on NPR, and it was also shortlisted for the Golden Poppy Prize for Fiction. Beth is coming to Boise to talk about her book, and she's joining us right now. I want to welcome you to the program.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here today.
So, Beth, can you describe the beadworkers to folks who haven't read the book yet? What will people find inside it?
Well, as you mentioned in your intro, I am Native American. I am Nez Perce. And so I draw a lot on my Nez Perce culture and also my experiences as living in urban Indian communities in Portland and Eugene and in the Bay Area. And so there is a mix of stories, and the stories themselves are mixed genre. So there's actually a play in the collection. There's a poem. There are some other kinds of unconventional forms for a short story collection. So I would say if you are coming into the book, to just be open to the various forms that stories can take. That's what people will find is various forms, but all the stories, every single story involves beadwork in some way. That's what connects them. And that's also exploring the very different and significant ways in which beadwork has held our communities together through everything.
So with that said, Beth, how does the craft of beadwork really, tie the whole book together? Because as you said, it's in every part of the book.
Yeah. Well, I really wanted to bring attention to the role of beadworkers in holding the community together. And so there's one aspect. Well, first of all, my auntie was a master beadworker. And many artists in my family do beadwork. And I really marvel at the fact that we have these indigenous arts, not only beadwork, but weaving and all kinds of different art forms that have survived through everything, through the wars, through imprisonment, through boarding schools, through loss, displacement, poverty. People still can do these very same arts that we've always been able to do. And that is something to be able to continue to persist in making beautiful, beautiful works of art that also have these many functions, not only as art, but have many, many functions within our communities through everything. I think that's just such a testament to our ongoingness and the life that we center ourselves in. The work of beadwork itself is such a grounding activity. You know, you have your hands in it. There's this aspect in which you are sort of connecting yourself to these old designs. You are bringing your own innovation to it. And often beadwork is very meditative, and it can happen. You can do it by yourself, but often it's really beautiful to do beadwork with other people. Mm-hmm. And so there's a way in which I wanted the book to kind of be like the experience of coming to a beadwork table, where everyone is coming in, you're working on your own thing, but people are telling stories. They're bringing the pains that they have in their lives, but nothing is happening right there. None of that suffering is happening at the table. People are telling stories of things that they've lived through. They're giving advice. They're making jokes out of things that they've lived through. And this sort of passes around this sort of strengthening, this medicinal laughter, this kind of joy and connection, both to ancestors, but also to the people at the table and thinking about the future. And then the other aspect I wanted to think about was when we think about Indigenous protests, we often think about the American Indian Movement, or we think about the protests that happen at Standing Rock or at Mauna Kea, or these different kinds of like on the street kind of protests. And those are, or on the land kind of protests. And those are so important to be on the front lines. But there's this other aspect, the bead workers, the people who are in the background holding things together, the aunties and the grandmas and the elders who are praying and feeding people and taking care of the culture. And that is also a way of participating and a way of sort of a quieter kind of resistance movement that is happening there. It's just focusing your efforts on the ongoingness of your community and feeding all those people who then can go out to the front lines and adorning them with all the power of the beadwork. And the last thing I would say about this too is that I wanted to bring attention to the idea of beading also as prayer. So in English, the word bead is also bead, B-E-D-E, which is to pray. And a lot of traditions, you know, have actual beads as an aspect of prayer, like a rosary or like a Buddhist prayer beads. And so beading is also prayer. And so I wanted to bring attention to the idea that beadwork is also a spiritual activity, and the work of prayer and the work of spiritual strength is also a very enduring and beautiful part of our culture.
So,
those are the things.
I love all of that. Can we talk about one of the stories in the book, Fish Wars? Because this is, you wrote this from the perspective of an 11-year-old girl.
Yes.
Can you share a little bit of the story, but also why you decided to include this particular story in the book?
Yeah, you know, there's this aspect of my academic work and also my creative work that I think one thing I always want to bring attention to is that Indian wars are wars on Indian families. The entire family is brought into these conflicts. And these can be wars that are bureaucratic, that are about child removal or other kinds of things that happen in offices and in the abstract, but they can also be the wars of, you know, the War of 1877, the massacres, these other kinds of wars. So, but every war, even the recent things like the Standing Rock protests, the entire family gets brought in. And the fishing wars too, in the 1960s and 70s, the entire family is brought into the conflict, into having to defend fishing rights. And so I've always had this question, what would I do? What would I do as a mother if these wars came to me? What did Indian families do? What are they doing to protect their children, but also to defend their treaty rights, to defend their land, to defend their water? Mm-hmm. And so this is my question. So I wanted to show the experience of being brought into a war from the point of view of a child. So my narrator, Trudy, she sees her parents arguing a lot, and she starts worrying that her parents are going to get a divorce or her family's going to split up. Like, this is kind of a normal, like maybe some way that you would start piecing together what's going on. And so the opening of the story is she's like hearing her parents arguing and her dad's leaving at night and she doesn't know what's going on. And as the story moves forward, she starts to figure it out that actually what they're arguing about is how to deal with the fish wars. Who in the family is going to go out to defend? Who's going to take care of the children? How they are going to move through this? And so by the end of the story, like she's brought into this state of awareness of what their family and their tribe is up against. So choosing a narrator who's a child was for me a way to show that the face of the fish wars is the children, is their future and is their experience too.
I want to go back to one interview where you said that studying Nez Perce grammar has expanded your thinking. And you've also said it influenced how you wrote the book. Can you expand on that a bit? And how long have you been studying the language?
Oh, thank you for that question. I love talking about my language. It's so beautiful. I started more than 20 years ago. I mean, I guess I could say I started even before that because my aunt and uncle were both first language speakers. And they were both involved in language revitalization and support of language program. So I did learn some things from my auntie, but the serious study that I undertook of the language began when I was in graduate school, actually at Stanford. And I was able to work with this linguist here at Berkeley, Professor Haruo Aoki, who was the primary linguist of our language and wrote our dictionary and made many recordings and translations. He was here at Berkeley. And so when I was at Stanford, I was able to work with him and start to really understand the grammar and the language and to translate all these stories. And so from my work of translating the stories, I got to learn what are the aesthetics of our stories? What are the things that are characteristic of our stories? And so those story forms, the kinds of things that happen. For instance, the number five is very important in our culture. And so whenever something happens in a story, it's five. There are five wolf brothers. There are five, maidens. It's whatever. Five is the number. Five mountains, you know. So in my collection, I would always, when I needed to number something, I'd always give it the number five. There. And so in one of the stories, there's a game and the lucky roll of the dice is a five. So it's things like that that connects my stories to a longer genealogy of stories. Also, our language is verb-based. And so we form words that actually sound like sentences. Well, that actually are sentences, I should say, because our words are formed with a verb in the middle. And then there's a prefix. The prefixes are the who and the how. And the suffixes are the when and the where. So you can make entire sentences out of single words. And there's a number of indigenous languages that are shaped like this. And so the influence on my writing I've become a much more verb-centered writer. I think is a happy development in my work. Mm-hmm. So it's also changed some of the rhythmic patterns of my sentences. You see this especially in the story Falling Crows, where I'm trying to bring the rhythmic energy of the language in to the stories. Mm-hmm. So those things have really influenced me. And the work that I've done in the beadwork and since has been about, specifically grounding my work in using the creative arts for Indigenous language revitalization. And so I've just completed a collection of poetry in which all of the poems are focused, are centered on, the sound, the use, the idea behind particular Nez Perce words and sentences. And some of the poems are written entirely in Nez Perce.
How important is it, Beth, to revitalize these Indigenous languages? Because it's not just, Nez Perce. It's not just Native American languages. I mean, the Hawaiian language, right, is another language that through colonization was almost wiped out. And what is it like for you to, to be able to see the revitalization of your language?
It's incalculable, the value of the language. And in fact, this is a very, as you say, this is a very significant issue right now. It's a vital point for many Indigenous languages around the globe. And that's something that's been recognized by UNESCO, which has declared 2022 to 2032 as the decade of Indigenous languages, really trying to bring attention to the urgency of strengthening and revitalizing our language. And it's very, Nez Perce is such a beautiful language because of the way its grammar is structured and because of who we can be in our languages. that we can't be in other languages. And I think this is just true of every language. You can be and be, you can experience the world and understand a set of relationships that exist in the world through the grammar of the language. Like, grammar is about ordering relationships. And so when you're speaking through the grammar of the language, and when you're speaking these sounds, and you are, it's not just thinking, but it's like living through the language, you can live in a way that is true to that language, true to the culture, true to the land from which this language was born and exists, like, forever. And so, for instance, I was saying how our language, the prefixes and suffixes have all of this information. So the verb in the middle is the doing, but then to think that, you know, the subjects who are doing and the objects are all tied together, they're all in the same word. There's this intimacy in which I cannot do something without affecting you. Like, the whole sentence is, the whole word is connected. Mm-hmm. And also there are all of these directionals. And so you can't do something without thinking about where it happens or where it's going or where it came from. Like, all of that is required information for you to think, to make the word, to be able to think the word, to be able to do the thing. And so to exist in the language is a fundamentally embodied way of being in place and in relationship to other living beings in the world.
Well, and I would think too that, you know, so much of history, right, whether it's family history, is taken generation to generation through talking, right? I mean, like, the Hawaiians have mm-hmm. a term called talk story, where you're mm-hmm. you're sharing those old stories. Mm-hmm. And I would think that if, as you have studied your language, has it given you greater access to not only hear these stories, but to preserve them?
Well, I hope that everything that I do in my work strengthens the language, but the language also strengthens us. We are stronger when we know the language and have a relationship with it and continue to breathe it and live it.
So how are you hoping, when people read this book, what do you hope their takeaway is? Because first, it's beautiful. And I think how you described, you know, the bead working and how you just interconnected every single story like that. And it does give you just this truly inside look at, you know, at the Nez Perce culture.
Yes, I should thank you for that. I should say that when I'm writing these stories, I'm always thinking about my primary audience being other Indigenous people, other Native people. Mm. And the creation of this story is just like to share and pass these stories around. And so I imagine my audience being other Native people who will recognize characters, they'll recognize situations, they'll laugh at these. I mean, the book has a lot of humor in it, even with the kind of heavier things that it's carrying. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just one of the ways that we strengthen each other. At the same time that I focus on Indigenous people as my primary audience, I also just want to invite everyone in. And so the opening piece is a feast. And the idea is just like, just come in, you know? The idea of the book being a beadwork table is like, yeah, come sit down, join the circle, tell some stories, laugh too. So what is my dream of the book is, I think I've told people before that I feel kind of lonely down here in California. And I think a lot about my homelands and my family in the Northwest. And so I think when I was writing these stories, I was thinking about bringing myself closer to home and bringing myself closer to these communities that have been, urban communities too, have been so important in my life. And so I think my takeaway would be that other Native people would also feel drawn closer to their homes, drawn closer to their communities through these stories.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.